Why do I conduct my show on this matter? Mundo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mundo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroony.
Mundo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mundo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mundo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
All right, you goofy bastards, time to wake the hell up. It's time once again for yet another episode of the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. That's right, I'm the guy your bosses don't want you to listen to, the guy who's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace, because unlike so many other radio talk show hosts, I actually do work for a living. At least until they fire my ass for exposing all their bullshit. Our engineer Sock Puppet Sam is here.
Glad to be here, Joe.
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we do that, Sam, give us that URL again.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec at spellsouth.net.
All right. Thank you, Sam. Once again, I want to welcome all my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. My thanks to Ben Birch for hosting my archives. Also, my listeners at rantradio.com and radiopower.org and cadronpictures.com. Okay, before I begin with the usual crapola, I'm going to read you something. I'm going to read you an editorial I came across in the last couple of days about the prison torture case that so many people are talking about right now. But I'm not going to tell you where I got the editorial, what newspaper it's from, until the end of the show. And what I want you to do, what I want you all to do, is to see if you can guess which commie pinko newspaper it came from. The title of the editorial is A Failure of Leadership at the Highest Levels. Around the halls of the Pentagon, a term of caustic derision has emerged for the enlisted soldiers at the heart of the furor over the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, the six morons who lost the war. Indeed, the damage done to the U.S. military and the nation as a whole by the horrifying photographs of U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi detainees at the notorious prison is incalculable. But the folks in the Pentagon are talking about the wrong morons. There is no excuse for the behavior displayed by soldiers in the now infamous pictures and an even more damning report by Army Major General Antonio Taguba. Every soldier involved should be ashamed. But while responsibility begins with the six soldiers facing criminal charges, it extends all the way up the chain of the command to the highest reaches of the military hierarchy and its civilian leadership. The entire affair is a failure of leadership from start to finish. From the moment they are captured, prisoners are hooded, shackled, and isolated. The message to the troops, anything goes. In addition to the scores of prisoners who were humiliated and demeaned, at least 14 have died in custody in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The Army has ruled at least two of those homicides. This is not the way a free people keeps its captives or wins the hearts and minds of a suspicious world. How tragically ironic that the American military, which was welcomed to Baghdad by the euphoric Iraqi people a year ago as a liberating force that ended 30 years of tyranny, would today stand guilty of dehumanizing torture in the same prison used by Saddam Hussein's henchmen. One can only wonder why the prison wasn't razed in the wake of the invasion as a symbolic stake through the heart of the Ba'athist regime. Army commanders in Iraq bear responsibility for running a prison where there was no legal advisor to the commander and no ultimate responsibility taken for the care and treatment of the prisoners. General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, also shares in the shame. Myers asked 60 Minutes, too, to hold off reporting news of the scandal because it could put U.S. troops at risk. But when the report was aired a week later, Myers still hadn't read Taguba's report, which had been completed in March. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld also failed to read the report until after the scandal broke in the media. By then, of course, it was too late. Myers, Rumsfeld, and their staffs failed to recognize the impact the scandal would have not only in the United States, but around the world. If their staffs failed to alert Myers and Rumsfeld, shame on them. But shame, too, on the chairman and secretary who failed to inform even President Bush. He was left to learn of the explosive scandal from media reports instead of from his own military leaders. On the battlefield, Myers and Rumsfeld errors would be called a lack of situational awareness, a failure that amounts to professional negligence. To date, the Army has moved to court-martial the six soldiers suspected of abusing Iraqi detainees and has reprimanded six others. Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who commanded the MP brigade that ran the prison, has received a letter of admonishment and also faces possible disciplinary action. That's good, but not good enough. This was not just a failure of leadership at the local command level. This was a failure that ran straight to the top. Accountability here is essential, even if that means relieving top leaders from duty in a time of war. Okay, there you have it. And as I said, I'll reveal just where that editorial came from at the end of the program. By the way, I composed and conducted all that music myself, as well as playing every instrument. And if you believe that, I have a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell you. Stop laughing at me. My wife is laughing at me. I missed a show this week. I try to put out two shows every week, one on Thursday and one on Sunday, but work was really taking a toll on me, and my wife insisted that I knock it off and get some sleep. And, well, until I get paid actual money for doing this and can do this full-time, I guess you'll just have to deal with the fact that I can't keep as regular a schedule as I'd like. Also, it was my 3-year anniversary on Friday. My wife and I are really very happy, despite that thing the court order forbids me to talk about. Okay, enough of that foolishness. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know that I am on a personal crusade to get people to boycott Walmart because of its anti-worker environment. Now, keep in mind, it's not my intent to drive Walmart out of business, but rather to change their attitude towards their hourly workers. Walmart has faced lawsuits for such things as forcing employees to work past the regular schedule, sometimes for hours, without pay, while at the same time, of course, claiming that anyone who takes even a 15-minute break without clocking out is stealing from the company. They also lock overnight employees into the store so that if anyone needs to leave the building, a manager with a key must be called. And they've even been caught erasing hours from an employee's punch clock in order to lower their overhead, just assuming that the employee won't catch it. And unfortunately, a lot of times the employee doesn't because they're busy with other stuff. Now, according to an article in the New York Times that was written back on May 12th, union leaders, academics, and community activists held a meeting in Washington to begin mapping out a strategy to check Walmart's growing power and to press the company to improve its wages and benefits. Now, the meeting was convened by Andrew Stern, who is president of the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, and will include union leaders, professors who have studied Walmart, and leaders of community groups. Organizers also said that Barbara Ehrenreich, I hope I pronounced that correctly, who is the author of Nickeled and Dimed, An Account of Making a Living as a Blue-Collar Worker, would also attend. Now, Mr. Stern, the SEIU's head, has been leading the charge to stop what he calls the Walmartization of the American workplace. And my friends over at therightchristians.org are also covering the story. That's therightchristians.org. It's run by Reverend Alan Verrill, a very, very good website. Now, Walmart's anti-worker policies are affecting other companies, pushing down wages and benefits, not just among retailers, but throughout the economy. As well as paying hourly wages that are near the poverty level, in fact, full-time hourly workers earn an average of $9.64 an hour, which is about $18,000 a year, 40% of their workers do not have company health insurance, mainly because they cannot afford to pay the price for it. But there was a quote in the article from Sarah Clark, who is a Walmart spokesperson, And I wanted to bring this one to everyone's attention. In defending Walmart, she said, and I quote, 90% of its employees have health benefits through some plan, perhaps a spouse's or through state Medicaid. Now, isn't that nice? I somehow get the feeling that Ms. Clark gets a slightly better benefits package than the hourly employees, and she's also more well paid. Am I saying these things correctly? She's better paid than any of the hourly employees. You know, that's just the thing about being a radio show. So how can I be a good radio show host if I can't properly pronounce these words? Anyway, but isn't that nice that they don't mind that they're foisting people off into Medicaid, which is already having trouble in state Medicaids because the federal government, having lower taxes on all the rich people, is no longer sending money to the states or as much money as they used to, and therefore the states have to cut back benefits on, like Medicaid. I want to urge everyone listening to this show to boycott Walmart and to support the SEIU in their efforts to reform Walmart so that what happens to their employees does not also happen to you. This is a very important thing because you don't want the standards to be so lowered that your jobs are affected. Where I work, I have a union. And if we didn't have the union there, I'd be lucky to be making $7, $8 an hour because basically what I do is unskilled work. And we had a new contract recently, and I just got a small raise, so I'll be making probably a little more than $12 an hour, hopefully, which is not too bad considering that my current overhead is pretty low. But I don't exactly live in luxury. I mean, my wife and I just basically renting a room in a basement. So anyway, let's have a little break. We'll hear from our friends at BuzzFlash.com. And we're going to come back with special guest Mark Satin, who is the author of the book, The Radical Middle. Don't go away.
The Copper Joe Radio Show will be right back.
Hi, kids. George Lowe, voice of TV's beloved Space Ghost. You are barking a happy tune with my close personal friend, the lovely Joe Vecchio, on the Cup O' Joe Radio Show.
Welcome to the BuzzFlash.com GOP Hypocrite of the Week. Today, BuzzFlash has a question. Of the supposedly rock-solid 45% of Americans who will vote for Bush, even if he grows devil's horns, how many of them are neo-Confederate white males? How many are Stepford Christians? How many of them are ignorant? And how many are just plumb stupid? After all, supporting an incompetent chronic liar when he daily takes actions that threaten the national security of the United States of America requires some explaining. That's why anyone who supports George W. Bush is our GOP hypocrite of the week. For example, ask the average Bush supporter to explain how this passes the common sense test. On the day that the first rush of U.S. torture, humiliation, and abuse photos emerged in the press, Bush celebrated the first anniversary of the Iraq War by declaring, quote, "A year ago, I did give the speech from the carrier saying that we had achieved an important objective, that we'd accomplished a mission which was the removal of Saddam Hussein, and as a result, there are no longer torture chambers or rape rooms or mass graves in Iraq." Unquote. Okay, maybe Laura didn't read the papers to Bush that morning, but Bush knew long ago about the torture chambers and rape rooms that Rumsfeld, Boykin, Fife, and the rest of the DOD had condoned at Abu Ghraib prison. As for the recent mass grave, there are reports that hundreds of women, children, and elderly killed in Fallujah are buried in a soccer field. Who killed them? Apparently U.S. forces. Collateral damage, you know, as the Bush cartel tried to crush the followers of a Shiite leader who wasn't a terrorist threat until we invaded Iraq. Of course, when the firestorm over America using torture, rape, and mass killings in its effort to liberate the Iraqi people from torture, rape, and mass killings, hit peak levels, Bush went to the Pentagon to view terrifying photos he claims he never saw. Yes, and he took one look at the Saddam-style horrors perpetrated under the Rumsfeld-Cheney high-stress interrogation methods, and then emerged to proclaim to the press that Rumsfeld was doing a, quote, superb job, unquote. If there are two Americas, which there does seem to be, then these were defining moments. Either you see an anti-democracy serial liar engaged in surreal, in-your-face hypocrisy, or you see an entitled knight engaged in the bloody crusades where non-believers were slaughtered as an army of God ravaged its way across Europe and the Middle East. And it doesn't really matter what he says or does, because his fate and the fate of the nation are in the hands of Jesus. There really isn't much room to maneuver between these two prism frames, is there? But America is a democracy, as far as we know. General Boykin, the anti-Islamic military leader who still enjoys the support of Bush and Rumsfeld, has said that Bush was chosen by God to become president. Well, he's half right about that. It was really Antonin Scalia, claiming that he was acting on behalf of the Almighty, who apparently told Nino to disregard the will of the American people on behalf of the Republican Party. But that leads us back to the Bush voters, who are hypocrites because they continue to support a man who lies so cruelly and with such wanton abandonment. You can't be a believer in our Constitution and in the democracy created in 1776 and so shamelessly champion an individual who defiles the office of the presidency and undermines the concept of democracy at every turn. For these and many more reasons, too numerous to detail, we honor all the Kool-Aid drinkers who continue to support the village idiot of the world. You, the rock-solid Bush base, are our 31st GOP Hypocrite of the Week. Until next week, just remember our motto at BuzzFlash.com. So many Republican hypocrites, so little time. Catch up with you soon.
And welcome back to the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man. And we have a very special guest with us here today. It's Mark Satin. It's not Satan, right?
Right,
it's
right.
It's Satin. And he wrote the book, The Radical Middle, which I was glad to get. By the way, I didn't realize that I got fringe benefits from doing this show. Politics We Need Now. And his publicist, Greg Hull. Hull, is that correct?
Hull.
Right. And he was kind enough to send me a copy of the book for free. And me being a poor person, I always welcome free stuff. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, Joe. You should always ask for free copies of books you're talking about.
Well, this is all fairly new to me doing the radio show, and I wasn't even aware right off the bat, or at least I didn't think about the fringe benefits of it. But I'm grateful for the book. It was a wonderful book. I read through the whole thing. It took me a little longer than I wanted because I had other things come up. But it's a wonderful book, and I probably agree with like 95% about it. Now,
that's frightening.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is kind of frightening. Now, talk to us about the book. What do you mean by radical middle, and how did you get involved with it?
Well, what I'm trying to get at in radical middle is that if we want to move forward in this country as a people, we have to stop fighting with each other, taking the left position or the right position and going after each other like we're kids in a schoolyard.
Mm-hmm.
What I think it's more important to do, and what I try to do in the book and in my life, is try to listen closely to what the left is saying and come up with what is essentially true in its message, but also I try to listen to what the right is saying and come up with what's essentially true in their message. And then I try to think of public policies that integrate the concerns and the deeper needs of people on the left and on the right, but that are different from policies that we have now, that really bring us into the 21st century, that don't stay stuck in the traditional left and right views, but we'll borrow from both, but move us on. And you're right to ask about why why I've come to this. I had a unique set of experiences. I was at one time a left-wing activist, quite radical. I mean, to be honest, about as radical as you could be. And to make a long story short, eventually I just got tired of that, and I went to law school and practiced corporate law for a while. And both events taught me a great deal. I mean, out of my left-wing experience, I learned to love combat and political struggle. But out of my corporate law experience, I learned that expertise and efficiency are crucial. You can't have a society without those things.
Right.
And so, you know, you just, at some point, as you get older, hopefully you get wiser. Well, and I saw that neither of those two sides of myself were right or wrong. They just pick up from different parts of what we need as a people. And wouldn't it be nice if some of us stepped back a little bit from this fray and tried to think of the American people as a whole and what we need as a whole.
Right.
And if we do, I mean, I think a lot of us, if we just looked at our own experiences, we would see that what I'm calling radical middle comes out of simply living an examined life. I mean, I don't want to sound like a Thoreau person, but it's true. If you look at your own personal experiences, you will not be able to be an ideologue. There's just too much that happens that falls through the cracks that you need to take seriously.
Well, while I personally believe that the right is worse about it than the left is, certainly there are elements of the left that can be just as nasty and just as mean as people on the right. And I'm more really of a centrist. Like I call myself a leftist, but I'm really more of a left moderate kind of guy, because I tend to see things in terms of, you know, working people and how to just help them make a better life for themselves. And while I agree with some of the things the right has to say, for the most part, there's such a bunch of obnoxious jerks that it's hard for me to take their message seriously. And I think a lot of people feel the same way about the left, too.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that we need to stop this all, because they're really both sides of the same coin. They both want better lives for everybody. They just want to go about it a different way.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's just a lot of very unpleasant people in the world who act out psychologically, and they tend to drift toward the partisan poles. And so I think if you spend too much time in either camp, you'll be turned off not so much by ideas, but by some of the people you meet along the way.
Well, I've gotten into fights with what I call the peace, love, dope crowd on the left side, who are
yes. They're
still stuck in the 60s. You know, I talk about how the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans in particular is that the Democratic leadership is still stuck in the 1930s and 40s with the same solutions to the problems that they had been with different problems, and the Republicans are stuck back in the 19th century.
Yeah.
You know, they want to go back to the Gilded Age.
I completely agree with you. Well, I mean, some Republicans, the supply siders, you could say, are stuck in the 1980s. But wherever they're stuck, it's a long ways from where we are today.
Well, nobody's looking towards the future. I mean, I kind of supported Al Gore because I thought at the very least he had an idea of what the future was going to be. Perhaps he was too poor a politician to phrase it properly, but I always thought that he had some decent ideas.
His ideas peaked in the late 1980s. He was really thinking for himself in original ways. He was one of the co-creators, for instance, of the Office of Technology Assessment, way before we realized that the economy was moving to a high-tech mode. And that would be a very interesting study, what happened to Al Gore, all that stuff about reinventing government, which was so essential, and to me, such an essential part of radical middle politics.
Right.
It was just drained out of his rhetoric well before he ran for the presidency.
Well, I think sometimes politics does that to people. You know, you get caught up in it. You get caught up in the game itself, and not part of what you're trying to do, what you're trying to accomplish with the game.
I would say it's not inevitable, though. I think one of the reasons this happens to politicians is that when they get into office, they don't really have values that they strongly believe in. They may have passionately believed in certain public policies, but unless you think coherently about the country as a whole, or in this day and age, about the planet as a whole, you're just quickly overwhelmed by detail and trivia once you get into office.
Well, isn't that partly the problem of the whole campaign finance system, the way, you know, the huge amounts of money that you have to raise and the corruption that normally comes with that, and also the fact that we now have congressional districts in particular that are so gerrymandered that people can feel free to be the most crazy radicals, like Tom DeLay can basically say anything he wants because he knows that the people in his district are going to vote for him regardless.
Yeah, this is a tragedy. You're putting your fingers on some essential things, actually stuff that I talk about in the book. There's almost no states do nonpartisan redistricting today. You've got Iowa, you have Washington State, and if you want to be generous, you could say Arizona has it. But virtually every state, the politicians get together with the computers and come up with what you could call designer districts that essentially exclude any possibility of opposition.
Yeah, it's
the saddest thing in the world.
Well, they do that. They used to do this all the time. I mean, it's not nothing new. It's just that with technology now, they can just fine tune it to almost a house by house.
Yeah,
type
it's,
of deal.
It's brilliant. It's just brilliant now in a kind of sad sort of way. Of course, they were trying to do it before, but even at the turn of the century, in the 19th into the 20th century, you had a majority of districts that on the congressional level were genuinely competitive. So there's been a gradual diminution of that over the years. By the way, there was one thing that you said earlier that I'm not sure I agree with. It is true that it's onerous to raise money, but I'm not sure that politicians can or should be able to use that as an excuse for not coming up with good ideas that are relevant for us.
Well, I think it's just a matter of the sheer amounts, and I think actually the idea of raising money is an important indicator as to what type of political support a candidate can get. If he's willing to get people to give them money, it just goes to show that, you know, people are definitely going to support him with more than just a vote. But I just think it's just gone so overboard, especially when you're talking about corporate donations, which I actually think should be illegal flat out. I think it just kind of skews the system.
Yeah, I would do away with corporate. I would do away with union. I would do away with all organized donations except for those from individuals.
Right.
That by the way, among all the ideas for political campaign reform, is one of the easier measures to enforce. One of the problems with campaign reform today is it's become so hugely complex that now you virtually need a lawyer in order to run for office.
Yeah, it's really bad. And what I think it's great that some parties like Dean's advocacy group, Howard Dean, who's forming his own thing, and they're running their own politicians, and you're running your own politicians essentially. You've made a list of those who you think are good radical middle politicians.
Yes.
Let me ask an obvious question, or an insulting question to Americans, but it's something I come across every day. Are Americans ready for this? I mean, I sometimes just get the impression that Americans are just stupid in a lot of the things that they do and see. And I know it's a rude thing to say, but you look at some of the things that go on and you wonder, are these people just stupid? Why are they continuing to vote for people like this?
Well, I mean, you're asking two good questions at once. I mean, in terms of the stupidity of Americans, I don't think we're any stupider than other peoples, but I do think we've ended up in a situation where we're so tempted not to think deeply about politics. It's more fun to make the other person wrong than to think about politics much. And as I'm sure you've noticed, God seems to have been eliminated from the public square, and as a result, politics is rushing into that space. It's become our new religion. So we use politics as a way of charging that each other is not a good person.
Well, that's interesting that you said that, because that's the first note of any kind of religion, because there was no mention of that in the book at all. You're not one of those who thinks that, you know, putting prayer back in schools is going to solve all of our problems, are you?
No, I'm not. But I do think it's important to address our potential as human beings. It's one of the four key values that I advocate. And by that, I do in part mean that we should think, as we're thinking about politics, we should not divorce ourselves from thinking spiritually about what we need as human beings. Much of what I say about the draft, for example, that it would be good for us to be drafted into national service, that we should have a choice as to how we should serve, military, civilian, or homeland security. Much of this has to do with the fact that if we do not, how can I put it, if we do not think clearly and carefully about who we're becoming as human beings, if we don't put ourselves in situations where we'll be forced to care for each other and to think hard about others, which is what all the great religions make you do, if we don't follow that to some extent, that golden rule path, I think we're sunk as a civilization. And whether you want to call that Christianity, Judaism, Islam, or whatever, you know, you can make a purely secular argument for this.
Well, you're of course talking about religion and not fundamentalism.
Well, there are many kinds of fundamentalists. I mean, I wouldn't want to blanketly condemn fundamentalists.
Well, religious fundamentalists in particular, the ones who want to kill anybody who's not, you know, doesn't believe what they believe.
Well, I don't think you need to bring an author on your show to condemn that.
Yeah,
no.
True.
I mean, I went to high school in Texas, and my girlfriend's mom said that as soon as the prom was over, I couldn't date her anymore because I was Jewish. Now, that's the kind of fundamentalist that I think really needs to relax and take a few deep breaths and step back. That's just seems to me odious, not because I may disagree with that person's church, that's not even relevant, but because it doesn't permit us to get to know each other as human beings in this country. And if we don't know who we are as Americans, if we don't know who we all are here, why should we be patriotic at all?
Exactly. There's no sense of community.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things I haven't written about it, but one of the things I would like to do for everybody is to have, maybe not necessarily a draft, but have everybody go to some form of basic training. I mean, everybody, rich, poor, black, white, everybody. And just put them all together with a group of people from all over the country, different types, different religions, different colors, and bring them all together and make them work towards a goal for 6 weeks. And I think that would do a lot to get rid of a lot of the prejudice and racism that we see here, just by showing people, hey, it's not what you've been taught, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a marvelous idea. I call for something somewhat like that in my book, Radical Middle. I would throw everyone together at the age of 18. And even a pacifist, I mean, rich, poor, young, old, male, female, halt, lame, put all of them together. And if they can't or won't do the military training because it frightens them or bothers them or is against their conscience, then have them do nonviolent civil disobedience. That can be just as taxing on the nerves and even physically if you've ever done a demonstration that lasts days and days.
Just so long as they do something that gives them involved with the community.
Yes, exactly. I would, in fact. This would be a draft, in my opinion. I would have the civilian service for 1 year, Homeland Security for 2 years, military service for 3 years, and the people who choose to do military service should, who are often poor and minority, should, in return for this military service, get the World War II GI Bill. In other words, no matter how awful the circumstances you come from, if you choose to do military service, you should be able to join the knowledge economy if that's what you want to do.
Sure, and also you can do things like my dad was a member of the old Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCCs, that did a lot of excellent work out in the West, you know, stopping firefights or fires.
Exactly. If you want to do that, I wouldn't give you a GI Bill, but I'd certainly give you a stipend so you can live and do that work.
Right.
But I there's a difference when you're putting your life at risk in a situation where people are shooting at you. So I do think they should be more highly rewarded. But of course you're right to imply, as you just did, that all of this work is necessary. I am a capitalist. I believe very strongly in capitalism, which I find the most exciting as well as the most efficient form of social organization.
Well, I'm a capitalist too. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to over. What did you say?
I'm sorry, I'm a capitalist too.
Okay, well, here we are, capitalists. But both of us, I think, Joe, would agree that there are a lot of things that don't get done in this society that need to get done, and they just don't fit into the capitalist system. I mean, you gave a great example, some varieties of civilian conservation, and another good one is we now have a lot of older people who do not want to stay in nursing homes and would like to stay in their homes. But no one is checking on them. No one is comforting them. Often they've lost most or all of their friends. And I think it would be wonderful. In fact, I think if we are a true community, it would be necessary for people to come and comfort them once a day or a couple times a week. And that too, it just doesn't fit into the capitalist economy. And what better way to involve us as a community in each other's lives than to build that sort of thing into a national service commitment?
Before I continue, let me first mention the website, because I hadn't done that yet. It's radicalmiddle.com, www.radicalmiddle.com. And there you can find all the information about the book, especially how to order it. And it's a very good book. I highly recommend anybody buy it. And you've been running the Radical Middle newsletter for quite some time as well.
For 5 years.
Yeah. So I've got it.
In that sense, the book represents 5 years of full-time, I mean more than full-time, like Washington workaholic time work.
Right.
But don't worry. I mean, the book, as I guess you've indicated, the book is not one of your high policy tomes. It speaks about ideas at length, but it speaks to them from the point of view of a human being.
Right. I like
the life.
The writing style is very, very readable. I've tried to read a lot of policy works and policy books, and I just kind of get bored with it after a while because it's just either over my head or the language they use is so vague that I really just can't comprehend what they're talking about. Listen, we're going to take a little break right here, and we're going to come back with Mark Satin, author of The Radical Middle. Okay, we're back with Mark Satin, author of The Radical Middle. And again, that URL for that is radicalmiddle.com. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Joe.
Okay, now, the two things to me that are most important in a society are the workplace and education. Now, you can't really have a good workplace unless you have a good education. And I wanted to say, first of all, how glad I was throughout your book that in no place in there you said anything about home-based schools, vouchers, or privatizing the public school system in any way. In fact, you state quite clearly that the federal government must take a stronger hand in our education. Tell us a little bit about that, and how do you feel about that?
Well, I say that for a reason. I mean, there are many clever, wonderful people in this country who can homeschool, but to make that a policy choice for most Americans is just absurd. Even if we have the skills, we don't have the time. And one of the worst things about our educational system today is that it's so unequal. I certainly don't think that bright kids should be held back, as they are in some school settings today. But at the same time, one of the key values that I speak about in my book again and again and again is how can we give everyone in this country a fair start in life? I mean, who would even want to live in a country that doesn't permit its citizens to get a fair start?
Right.
And in a high-tech era, with such as we're entering, if you don't get a good education, if you don't have at least a crack at it, you're left out of the mainstream from the start.
And one of the things I think that's wrong with the whole voucher thing to begin with is that people aren't necessarily going to choose what group is going to give the kid the best education, but what group is going to indoctrinate them with whatever religious or other ideology that they want their kid to grow up with. I mean, that can be a very dangerous thing. You don't want people to be growing up, having an education that says, oh, evolution isn't true, or, biology isn't true, or something like that. You have to, we're just basically teaching the scriptures or something like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, of course. I wouldn't abolish the private schools. And unfortunately, I think, people should have that option, because another one of my key values is how can we give ourselves more choices in life. But if a kid by the age of 7 or 8 or 9 does not want to follow in their parents' footsteps, I do not think the parent should have the right to force a child to go to a school where that child feels uncomfortable or where they feel they're not getting a full education.
Well, that sounds kind of hard to enforce, though.
Quickly.
I mean, that sounds kind of hard to enforce, though.
I mean, how can you, you know, you're talking about a parent, kid who's 7 or 8 or 9 years old. I mean, how can you, you know, take them away from their parents or, you know, force them to go to, you know, can you see that happening with a kid? Well, I don't want to go to this school. And the parents say, well, you will go to this school. And how do you settle that from a legal point of view?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a situation where there are no good choices. I mean, you raise the issue of, do you want a parent to be able to send a child to an extraordinarily narrow, perhaps prejudiced school? And I would say, well, we really can't ban private schools, and some private schools are going to be taught out of a religious or out of an ideological context.
Well, I'm not against private schools per se, but I'm certainly against using taxpayer money to fund these, you know, semi-religious organizations.
Well, right. I would agree with you. I would simply say that students themselves, if they feel uncomfortable in those private schools, should be able, I mean, I don't get into this level of detail in my book, but they should be able to have some say in the matter. At a certain age, whether it be 8 or 10 or 12, students are pretty aware. I mean, I'm sure if you don't have kids, you certainly know children who at 10 or 12 are really aware of what's going on around them.
Right.
Kids are often savvy in ways that adults are not, and kids pick up pretty quickly when they're being fed a line. And so I just think there should be some room for children to be able to opt out of a private school if they care to. The larger issue, though, which is more important to address, is the reason I call for federal funding of the schools is because some schools receive 3-4 times more money than other schools now. And it's just not fair. It's just not fair, not just to individual children who are caught in the less affluent schools.
Well, we see
it's
that here in Atlanta.
To the American community to do this to ourselves.
Yeah, here in Atlanta, you have the schools out in the suburbs in places like Alpharetta and Roswell, which is where all the rich white people run away from because they don't want to stay in the inner city of Atlanta. And because the tax base for property values is so much more there, their schools are much better well-funded, you know, much, much better funded than schools in the inner city here in Atlanta, which are always having to face cuts and stuff like that. So a federal government could equalize that out a lot more so that everybody, regardless of, you know, race or wealth, and that's what I want to talk about a second, can have a better chance. So you talked about socioeconomic affirmative action as opposed to racial affirmative action. And let me read a couple of quotes here real quick.
Sure.
And this is from your site. And this is a quote from Richard Kahlenberg, who's the author of, I hope I pronounced that right, author of Altogether Now, Creating Middle-Class Schools Through Public School Choice.
Right.
And he writes, while it's true that blacks and Latinos are disproportionately poor, racial affirmative action does little to help poor and working class students of color, let alone poor and working class students generally. Now, in a response to that, John F. Witt, actually was a review of the book, who wrote it for Education Next. John Witt said, what's telling for Kahlenberg's recommendation is the reception that greeted his proposals. He says he gave 3 speeches in the Milwaukee suburbs promoting the plan, and the response wasn't just frigid, it was blatantly hostile. No arguments could overcome the hostility, though he explained how not all kids would be bused to the inner city. After an absolutely dead-on arrival reception in the legislature, the plan was dropped and has never reemerged in any fashion. Now, why is the American education system so against the idea of socioeconomic affirmative action as opposed to racial affirmative action?
Well, just to get back to Kahlenberg for a minute, what I think he was getting at in those speeches in Milwaukee was not the idea of affirmative action, but he wants to create a situation where all schools contain an approximately equal mix of blacks, Hispanics, and whites. And I think I would assume that what the suburbanites were rebelling against was that aspect of his talk.
Do you think there's so much racial hatred in this country still that it's going to be difficult to promote any kind of real thing unless we can get rid of that racial hatred?
No, I don't. I think much of what's spoken of loosely as racial hatred is simply that people had their kids in the public schools after they'd been integrated, and it just wasn't working. I mean, the minorities who came needed so much extra help and were so and the extra help was not provided for them. It was the saddest thing in the world. The liberals didn't want to provide tutoring. because that might have implied that black people needed help. And, of course, it's politically incorrect to imply that. So the tutoring wasn't there, the counselors weren't there, the attempts to diffuse any racial hostility in the schools weren't made because it might have been seen as racist to bring in mediators. And I mean, in many ways, liberals are responsible for the explosion that took place in the mid-70s when the schools in the North finally were truly integrated. So I don't think it's fair to say racism is at the heart of the resistance. I think Americans weren't willing to pay the money it took to integrate properly, and liberals in particular weren't willing to take the preparatory measures it took because it might have caused them to imply that that blacks weren't exactly ready to sit down in the classes and learn in the same way with the same diction, and it was just really a mess.
They weren't really addressing the problem; they were addressing an ideology.
Exactly, they saw it through these rose-colored ideological lenses rather than seeing that both blacks and whites needed to be thoroughly prepared for this situation, and the preparation wasn't done. The explosion took place. And everyone went off and accused each other, and those accusations have been raining down on the school system for the last 30 years. It's one of the saddest things in the world because, of course, the only people who were really hurt by this were America's children.
And the black children in particular, too.
Who had the idea reinforced. The white children, to the extent that you really need to grow up in a mixed racial schools in order to have some sense of who's out there as a people. So I think you could say that it hurt both. What I do like about Kahlenberg's approach, though, and I do adopt this in my book, is that there is no reason to have schools. Now I want to jump to colleges, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. What Kahlenberg is really good at is talking about how colleges can integrate. He says that what we do now by looking at race and creating colleges with a decent number of black and Hispanics in it, even if you have to use quotas or quasi-quotas, he says it's totally unnecessary to do that. And moreover, he says, when you do that, you typically let in minorities as well as whites who are much richer than the national average, even though their scores aren't on the SAT scores and the grades are approximately the same. He goes through many studies, as do a couple of his colleagues at the Century Foundation here in Washington, Anthony Carnevale is one, that show that by looking at grades and SAT scores, but also at the income of the parents, you don't look at the race, you just look at the income of the parents, as well as grades and SAT scores, you can boost the percentage of students in our top-tier colleges who come from the bottom economic half of the country from 10% to 38%. And you can do that without looking at race. And
sure,
since the way disproportionate number of people who come from the bottom half are black, Hispanic, or Native American, their numbers go up just as much as they would under a race-based affirmative action.
Well, I know there have been a couple of articles, and one in the New York Times in particular, that talked about how in the upper-tier colleges, something like 75 to 80% of the students who go to these schools come from families where the income is like $100,000 or $200,000 a year. And, much less poor people and middle-class people are getting to attend these upper schools. And some of the schools, some of the Ivy League schools in particular, are trying to change that, maybe taking a radical middle approach to it, trying to look at it. Well, maybe we ought to do it for, low-income people as opposed to just racial stuff.
Exactly. You look at parental wealth, you look at parental occupations, you look at whether people come from single-parent homes, you look at the poverty rate of the neighborhood or the high school. Americans are willing. I mean, every study I've seen, every poll I've seen, shows that Americans are willing to lend a helping hand to people who've really been hurt by the economic depression of their backgrounds. But Americans are not willing to help simply because because of your skin color. I mean, many people from any race come from extremely privileged backgrounds. And Carnevale and Kahlenberg have both done studies showing that the people who are helped now by affirmative racial affirmative action tend to be people from the very top economic tier, whether they be black, Hispanic, or white. And economic affirmative action would change that. You would end up helping at least as many minorities anyway, but you would be helping the ones who, because of their low incomes or because of their poverty scarred backgrounds, are the ones who truly need help.
And in the long run, it would be better for the country. Now,
in the short run, it would be better for the country.
Yeah, but in the long term too. I mean, not just the part. People sometimes tend to look for short term solutions and not long term stuff.
Well, you've just put your finger on what's so important to me about the radical middle. What all of us do who call ourselves radical middle, and you too, if you would call yourself by that term, is we try to look at the long term needs of everyone. The Democrats are locked in to the needs of trial lawyers, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, union members, secondary and elementary school teachers, and the Republicans, well, we all know what they're locked into.
Yeah.
But they're locked into groups. They're not locked into the needs of the country as a whole. And we desperately need a political point of view that does take the long-term interests of all the American people into account.
Right. Now, one of the things that mentioned in the book about and some other people with different ideas, and you just go over them, the idea of stipends. And you mentioned that you were once part of the New Age movement, people talking about books about self-actuation and all that stuff. But, of course,
yeah,
a lot of those people you mentioned got a big head start of their own from trust funds or inheritance and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the right, you have people who talk about personal responsibility, but, of course, also, you know, have a nice fat nest egg waiting for them.
Right.
Now, how can we balance out the scales a little bit to give working slobs like me a better chance at real self-fulfillment?
Well, I think there's some concrete things we can do that I think, interestingly, most Americans, according to the studies I've seen, would support. One is we can provide subsidies to employers so that any American who wants a job can have a job. I think it's appalling that we have people who want to work who cannot find work. There's no reason for it. There's too much to do in this country. I mean, you and I both know. In fact, you and I both work far more than 40 hours a week just to do work that's essential to keeping us all going. And by providing subsidies to employers rather than simply providing public sector jobs, you'll be able to put all Americans into jobs where they don't feel that, you know, you won't have any American feel that he's working at a job because the government is funding some entity so that they can stay off the street.
Right.
And the other thing that I would do that I think is really, really important for a whole bunch of reasons is I'd have what's often called individual development accounts or what I prefer to call nest eggs or stakeholder accounts. The government will put a couple of $1,000 into the bank for you when you were born. Some people would say when everyone is born. I would say when people in poor environments are born. I just don't think that middle-class entitlements are sustainable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, everyone, at the very least, everyone who needs them would get, say, $5,000 at birth. And what's interesting is by the time the person turns 18, there would be $20,000 or $30,000 sitting in the bank for you to be able to use for college, for starting a small business, for buying a home. In other words, any child, even if they come from the most hardscrabble background, by the time they're 18, would grow up knowing that by the time they reach 18, they would have this fund to draw upon.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then, because I know some 18-year-olds, and frankly, I wouldn't trust some 18-year-olds with $20, let alone $20,000. How do you keep them from blowing that money on lap dances and Girls Gone Wild videos?
Well, you would have to enforce, and there's been complex proposals to do this, but you would have to enforce that money would have to be spent. You couldn't take it out till you're 18, and then if you do take it out, you would not really take it out. It would be channeled. It would be funneled either to a university or to a small business lender or to a real estate agent. In other words, you wouldn't be able to play with it. It would go directly from your bank to the entity that you'd be using it in. And there's only a couple of entities that you'd be able to use it on.
Well, frankly, I wouldn't have it to go towards a house. That's just my deal. I would have it. I like the education or the small business thing, but I wouldn't have it going towards a house. I mean, while a house is nice, you know, it really doesn't do anything for self-improvement as far as I'm concerned.
The reason I had the house is that there's a lot of women, especially, who want to stay at home. They just do. I mean, they want to get married and stay at home and have kids. And so this is my option for them. I mean, if that's what they want to do in life, why shouldn't they have an equal right to do that?
Good point. Okay, let's... We're running out of time here, and I want to try to talk about the workplace. Yeah, it just goes so quickly. I want to talk about the workplace very briefly. And you mentioned that you did work for a while as a regular industrial worker. I think you mentioned your whole job for 8 hours a day was to sit there and grab four crabs at a time, and load them into a box.
Yeah, I was good at that.
But you were bored to tears by it, though. I mean,
within an hour or two of showing up at work, and it was a good job. It was a Teamsters job.
And I work in a similar kind of deal. I mean, I work on a paint line. I basically pull metal parts off of an overhanging conveyor belt.
Oh, my.
And, you know, all day you grab stuff off of there and just lay it on the pallets. And it's really, like you said, it's not a bad job.
Yeah.
But after a while, it's like, what am I doing here? You know, and of course, there's the whole usual, you know, the stuff that goes on in the workplace. How can we do this more efficiently? And, of course, nobody seems to listen.
Nobody listens. That's the extraordinary thing. I've never been at an industrial job or a boring office job, for that matter, where you couldn't make wonderful improvements in the efficiency.
And make a workplace better and still maintain the good productivity. But
exactly.
There seems to be an attitude by both workers and management to just not do these things. Do you think there's an inherent problem with all humans that just makes them resist this sort of change?
Well, sure. I mean, there's psychological problems with this sort of thing. Who gets the credit? Does it mean I'll lose my job? Some of this is built into the human animal, but a lot of it can be done away with through public policy. For example, if we lose a job now, we'll lose our health benefits.
Right.
There's no retraining. If you're very lucky, if there's good retraining, let's put it that way. In my world, we would separate employers from health insurance. We would still have private health insurance, but the government would subsidize people, and the government would require that people carry health insurance, as it does now require people to have car insurance.
Right.
But if you can't afford it, you would be subsidized to the extent that you need it. And I've already spoken of how anyone who wanted work in a radical middle society, it would be there because the government would subsidize jobs through private companies to the extent that needed to be done in order to provide work for all.
Or provide direct work, like we mentioned with the CCCs or through the military even, in that sense.
Exactly.
So, well, listen, I really hate, because we've been having such a wonderful conversation here, and I hate to cut the whole thing short, but we're pretty much out of time. Actually, we're about a minute over. But listen, Mark, I'd like to keep your phone number there so that we can continue on this conversation at a future date on a future show.
That would be a lot of fun. I think toward the end of the year, people are going to be so frustrated by the election that they'll be looking for alternatives even more than they are now.
Well, you know, I'm not. I was a Dean supporter before he got kicked out, and I think one of the problems in our society was how the Democrats treated Howard Dean. And I think that's a damn shame, because while he may not have been the perfect candidate, the things he brought to the table were things that I think need desperately to be addressed in this country. And while, you know, I admire Senator Kerry for, you know, the courage he showed in Vietnam and for, you know, his service to the country, I don't think he's really the best person for the job right now. But I'm going to vote for him because he's still better than the current group, which is basically Enron-type corporate culture brought to the U.S. government. But let's save that for a future discussion, shall we?
Right. Well, there's a lot to say there.
Mark, it's been great talking to you, and we'll talk again soon.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks, Joe.
Okay, that's just about it for this episode of the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I want to thank Mark Satin for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk to me. Oh, and before I forget, that Commie Pinko newspaper that wrote that editorial, The Army Times. See you all next time. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.